new report from Harvard University says Duval County sends too many convicted criminals to die. This morning, the state attorney's office rebuts those claims. Good Thursday morning, and live from Studio 5, this is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross. We are always live at 9. Make sure to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes and our WJCT app as well. And just ahead, we speak with the top prosecutors in the state attorney's office as they take your calls on the new Fair Punishment Report and Ms. Corey's campaign for re-election. We are also streaming this live on Facebook right now. Go to WJCT's Facebook page and watch the live stream. We'll answer your questions on Facebook Live as well. But you can call in with your thoughts and comments at 549-2937. Now, later in the hour, an international child abduction case here in Jacksonville has a happy ending thanks to the Hague Convention. We'll tell you about that. And a look to Florida State University's concert involving rare Steinways and the internationally renowned The Five Browns, all of that ahead. But first this hour, a new study out this week from Harvard University says Duval County is among a handful of U.S. counties that most frequently sends convicted criminals to their deaths. Harvard's Fair Punishment Project singles out 16 counties, including Duval, that have sentenced at least five people to death over the last 5 years. Duval had 16 death sentences, and according to the report, 88% of those sentences since 2006 were not the result of a unanimous jury verdict. Now, the report claims that overzealous prosecution, ineffective defense counsel, and, it says, racial bias are some of the factors leading to Duval's status as what it calls an outlier in application of the death penalty. The report released the same day a New York Times Magazine story took a critical look at this area's criminal justice system. However, State Attorney Angela Corey strongly disputes those findings, saying the statistics don't provide a complete picture. This morning, we're joined in studio by two of the state attorney's top prosecutors, Bernie DeLorianda and Mark Khalil, as they react to the report. Gentlemen, thanks for being here.
Good morning.
It's a pleasure to be here.
And lots of calls already. We want your calls right now at 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online to wjctnews.org/firstcoastconnect. You can email and tweet the show. And we are streaming this conversation live on our WJCT Facebook page. Watch the live video stream online and ask your questions there as well. All right, Bernie DeLorianda, let's begin with you. You are named in this report in addition to State Attorney Corey. It's called the Fair Punishment Project out of Harvard Law School, and it singles out Duval as one of just 16 counties that is aggressively applying the death penalty, calling Duval an outlier. Your reaction to this report, it's caused a fair bit of discussion so close to the primary election.
Well, first of all, it's a privilege to be a prosecutor. I've been doing this 33 years, and in that time, I've tried a lot of death penalty cases. I've put a lot of people on death row. I don't brag about that. I just look at it as a fact of life that I'm doing my job. The first thing that I have in terms of criticism of this report is people need to understand that it was published, and the emphasis for it was a anti-death penalty. So we need to go know where it's coming from. The second thing I think is very important for those that are against the death penalty, the biggest argument, I think, or the most valid argument, is that there are innocent people that potentially are on death row or have been executed. This report acknowledges, reluctantly, that there are zero people on death row from Duval County that are innocent. So I want to stress that. All the people in Duval County that have gotten the death penalty are guilty. There's no issue as to their guilt. And that is an important thing for your listeners to understand. So we should get a little bit of credit for that, that there are no exonerations here. Second thing I think is important to focus on is our victims. This report focuses on the defendants because it's an anti-death penalty. I'd like to focus on, and we can talk about the defendants, but I want to focus on their victims. There's an allegation that there's racial bias in terms of how the death penalty is applied. I respectfully disagree. The cases that I've tried, and I've got a bunch of cases that I've tried, most of my victims, quite frankly, are black. I think their lives matter. I think their lives are just as important as a white person's. Let me give you one example of a case that I've tried, and so that your listeners can get a flavor of the kind of individuals that we're dealing with. And the person is David Sparre. His name is spelled S-A-S-P-A-R-R-E. He is on death row. He's been on death row since 2011. That jury voted 12-0 for the death penalty. He's also referred to as the Craigslist murderer. He contacted the victim, came down to Jacksonville from Georgia, and brutally killed her while he took his grandmother to the hospital while she was having heart surgery. He stabbed her over 89 times. She suffered through this. And the most compelling thing, I think, or one of the most compelling things about this murder is that he actually wrote a letter to his girlfriend or ex-girlfriend at the time, and he bragged about how he did it. He stated, he described in great detail how she was suffering and how he planned to do it, how he got such a rush. Let me quote, he stated, "I did it for the rush. I planned for a week and a half and how I would do it. I'm not even going to lie. I enjoyed it. I hope to do it again. The first time I killed someone, I shot them." And anyway, he talks about other stuff that he's done.
And let me bring Mark Khalil into the conversation. Now, Mr. Dillarionda is pointing out that many of the victims seeking justice are in this circuit are African American, something that the SAO has brought forth as an important wrinkle to this data. Let me ask you, and I'm quoting from the study's author, Rob Smith, who was originally booked on this program but canceled. And he says, in Duval County, what happens is you have both this aggressive prosecutor in Angela Corey, where she seeks the death penalty in cases where many other prosecutors would not, and also a non-unanimous jury rule. Until recently, that was the law of the land in Florida. The law didn't used to require any specific number of jurors to agree to a death sentence. It now requires a 10-2 decision. Those two things work together. And Smith says, in places like Duval, people on death row were not always the most heinous criminals. Instead, the report noted 48% had an intellectual disability, severe mental illness, or brain damage, and 1 in 5 were younger than 21. So, Mark Khalil, what about the criticisms that are embedded in that part of the report?
Let me address the mental retardation or intellectual ability aspect of that, because they specifically cited one of the cases that I handled along with Ms. Corey. It was the case of Thomas Brown. For your listeners, so they understand the facts and circumstances, to remind them of this was a case of very horrible murder that occurred when Mr. Brown brutally murdered his coworker in a Wendy's at lunch hour while she was standing to order her lunch after she finished her shift. He walked up behind her, shot her from behind, went to leave, and then went back, stood over, and told her and the whole restaurant full of people, "I told you I was going to kill you," and then fired one last shot into her head and executed her, basically. Mm-hmm. There were claims during the course of the prosecution of this case that Mr. Brown may have been mentally retarded or intellectually disabled. That was brought forward by an examination by the defense expert, Dr. Harry Kropp, and a motion was originally filed in that particular case claiming that he was intellectually disabled. Based upon the filing of that motion, we had our own expert examine Mr. Brown. Our own expert, Dr. Reebsame, found that he was malingering, which means he was exaggerating symptoms or faking at times during the course of the examination, and found also that he was well above the threshold for mental retardation. And part of that legal analysis is when you go back and you look at the individual's psychiatric history, and he had a psychiatric history with the state because prior to this homicide, he committed a violent armed robbery where he again had a gun and put it in somebody's face and grabbed them by their head. And based upon the evidence of the experts, even the defense's own expert had to concede he was not mentally disabled. And so one of the criticisms was that Mr. Ghazala, who represented the defendant during trial, withdrew this motion. Well, he was required to do so because the ethics of lawyers within the state of Florida require that they're not allowed to make arguments to the court or to delay court process if they do not have a good faith basis to proceed with those motions. And because the experts all agreed that Thomas Brown was not meeting the criteria for retardation to prevent him from being subjected to the death penalty, they were required to withdraw that motion. And it should be noted that Dr. Kropp even testified at the penalty phase in this particular case and conceded on cross-examination that Mr. Brown was neither insane at the time of the offense or was mentally retarded, which would prohibit him from being sentenced to death. And so I think that that area of the report is very misleading because it takes portions of information out of pleadings without getting the whole picture and the whole truth behind what actually happened in that case.
And certainly your boss, Angela Corey, has been consistent in the past when critical stories like this have been published, saying she feels they are misleading. We appreciate you both being here today to talk about the particulars of these data points. We had originally booked State Attorney Corey to appear on the program, but there was a change, and so we appreciate you being here today. We'll go to calls for Bernie Dillarionda and Mark Khalil in a moment at 549-2937. You can also watch the live video stream on our WJCT Facebook page. Now, let me ask you, Bernie, a new report is out actually today from UNF's Public Opinion Research Lab, and it finds that the incumbent Angela Corey is trailing challenger Melissa Nelson in the state attorney's race by 30-some points, Nelson leading Corey 52% to 20%. What would you say to those listening right now who perhaps voted for Angela Corey the last time, but they are thinking perhaps of voting for one of the challengers, given the controversies that have dogged her tenure in office?
Melissa, I'm here to talk about the death penalty, and that's what I thought we were here to talk about. I respect asking the question.
Yeah, but we thought she was going to be here.
I understand. I'm not here to talk about politics. I'm here to talk about the death penalty. I will tell you that in Duval County, Clay, and Nassau, we seek the death penalty in appropriate cases. We are not ashamed of doing so. We feel that the cases that merit the death penalty, and we're very judicious in terms of, people have to understand how many murders first are committed, how many people are arrested, and there's a select few that only are eligible for the death penalty. And those, we seek it, and we don't apologize for seeking it.
Let me quote again from the report. Of the death sentences that the Florida Supreme Court reviewed from Duval since 2006, one in every six involved a finding of inappropriate behavior, misuse of discretion, or prosecutorial misconduct, including two recent death sentences tried by Dillarionda that the Florida Supreme Court vacated due to their excessive harshness. What would you say to those reading this report who feel that the circuit is too harsh when it comes to application of the death penalty?
Well, I'm glad you asked that question, because that is a criticism that is unfair in this sense. They allege misconduct. Where is their proof of it? I've tried a bunch of cases. They're all on death row, and there has been no proof of misconduct. So let's make that clear. Nor am I aware anywhere in this circuit where there has been a finding of prosecutorial misconduct. They throw that in as part of a paragraph. Now, there is a point, which is valid from their standpoint, that the Supreme Court in two of my cases determined that, in their opinion, the person didn't deserve the death penalty. I respectfully disagree. Quite frankly, so did the jurors disagree. In one of those cases, I think it was 10-2 or 11-1 or maybe even 12-0. In my opinion, there was a merit in going for the death penalty. Also, the judge made a determination that the death penalty was valid.
Let's go to some calls right now. Lots of folks waiting on hold. 549-2937. Let's go to Larry in downtown Jacksonville. Go ahead, Larry.
Yeah, I just want to make a point. Every study that I've looked at and read about, and most of the public, they're really for the death penalty because they don't think that they should pay to house somebody and keep them for the rest of their life. But every study that I've read about says that it's cheaper to house them than to kill them because of all the ramifications of going to court over and over again on the trial. So I just think it ought to be thrown out there that there's no saving of money by executing someone. It's cheaper to house them for life. That's all I got to say.
Okay. Mark Khalil.
Well, one response I have to the financial argument is this, is how much is justice worth to this community and to the victims of violent crime? Also, using again the example of Thomas Brown, Thomas Brown was what we call a prison releasee reoffender, which meant that he had just gotten released from prison for a vicious armed robbery. He was still on parole and controlled release and being supervised. Under the laws of the state of Florida, even being convicted of another armed robbery, he would be facing mandatory life in prison without the possibility of parole. Okay. So in essence, what you're talking about here is because he's facing a mandatory life sentence even on a lesser offense such as a robbery, you know, where does the community draw the line and tell these violent offenders when you commit certain acts under certain circumstances which dictate that the crime is so aggravating, you must have the punishment in place that is a deterrent to these violent actors. And otherwise, Mr. Brown could go out and commit multiple offenses and still be just subjected to a life sentence, regardless whether it's murder or whether it's robbery. And I don't think that's fair to the victim in that case, who was a young mother whose child has been orphaned as a result of Mr. Brown's actions.
What would you say, as a follow-up question, to the report's overall finding, though, that as the death penalty is declining generally around the country, Duval, when you look at the numbers in the aggregate, is an outlier, that among 15 other counties. When it comes to application of the death penalty, we have about 5% of the state's population, but this circuit is racking up about 40% of the death penalty cases in the overall.
Well, and I think you have to look at overall Ms. Corey's entire tenure, first and foremost. Actually, 22 individuals were sentenced to death since Ms. Corey took office in 2009. One thing to note, though, is you also have to look at the entire history of Duval County, including Ms. Corey's predecessor, Mr. Shorstein. 8 of the death sentences received in Ms. Corey's administration, the notice of intent to seek the death penalty was filed under the previous administration. There has been no change in the stance of the citizens and the juries and the prosecutors in Northeast Florida as to how do we address violent crime. I can't speak as to why there has been a change nationwide. But what we have seen is a consistent handling of these most serious cases, and we take these decisions extremely serious and put a lot of thought and contemplation to it, but there has been a consistent application of the death penalty over the 20 years that I've been a prosecutor, and that included many years under Mr. Shorstein's administration.
Okay, let's go to Wells at the Beaches now. Hey, Wells, thanks for holding. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you, Melissa, for taking my call. Well, first I want to say I think it's interesting that Ms. Corey couldn't make it today. I want to state something to the prosecutors that are there, because I have been in meetings where they have been, and the first thing they lead off with are these horrific crimes. And the second thing they talk about is how they have defended the victims, who a lot of them are African-American. I'm a 70-year-old African-American man. And the whole country understands that there is racial bias in the way people are arrested, how people are stopped and searched. And I can't really understand why people come out, why these two gentlemen are here talking about these reports are not accurate. So we have the Human Rights Watch report, the Time Magazine, and the Harvard report. I don't get that. I think what's happening is the country is grown wary of the police killings, mass incarceration. So my question to them is, what are their views on the number of kids that have been locked up on misdemeanor charges and the number of children who have been tried as adults? And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you, Melissa.
Okay, thanks for that. Bernie De La Rionda, the most highly publicized case, of course, was that of, he was 12 at the time, Christian Fernandez, who was initially charged as an adult in the circuit for murder. What about that caller's question?
Well, actually, Mr. Khalil is the one that prosecuted Mr. Fernandez.
I'm just trying to give you both equal time.
No,
but yeah,
I appreciate it.
Yeah.
I mean, I'll talk in general. We prosecute the cases we feel we can prove beyond a reasonable doubt. We don't care on the race, ethnicity, or gender of the defendant. And we factor in the victim in terms of what the victim suffered. But I'll defer to Mr.
Yeah,
Khalil.
Yeah, Mark Khalil.
Well, specifically in regards to Mr. Fernandez's case, it was an extremely difficult case. Obviously, there were highly unusual facts, and it was decided that he be charged as an adult. And let's be clear, he was indicted by a grand jury. He was transferred to adult court for prosecution. What that did, it changed the venue, and it changed the sentencing options that were available to the court once the case reached resolution. And it should be noted that, and I think you said originally charged as an adult. Mm-hmm. He was charged as an adult. He pled in adult court. He received juvenile sanctions as to a manslaughter as to one count, and he was placed on probation following his juvenile commitment as an adult for his second charge, and he's going to be supervised as an adult for time frame following the incarceration. And
what
and,
about, though, the fact that a coterie of defense lawyers banded together to bring about a different result in his case? And in particular, Angela Cori's opponent, Melissa Nelson, has talked on the campaign trail at length about the fact that Fernandez, a 12-year-old, was shackled in the courtroom and placed in solitary confinement. That that case in particular has drawn criticism, Mr. Khalil.
Yes.
How that was handled.
Well, and first and foremost, the state attorney's office had no part in how the Jacksonville Sheriff's Office chose to house Mr. Fernandez. At one point in time, it was actually prior to this, these attorneys coming into the case, there was a motion filed by the predecessor attorney to have him sent back to juvenile detention. And that pleading that we filed in response to that motion is available, and people can read that. At no point in time were we saying that he should be held in isolation or he should even be held in an adult jail. We deferred to the Jacksonville Sheriff's Office, who were the experts in regards to that, and all we did in our response was we put forward concerns and issues and outlined the law for the court so that they fully understood the decision that they were making. As to the shackles in the courtroom, again, there has been this misconception out there that somehow the state attorney's office demanded that Christian Fernandez be in isolation, that we demanded that he had shackles placed upon him. Much like any defendant, whether it's a juvenile or an adult, those are decisions that are not made by prosecutors. Those are decisions made by those in corrections and those who are the experts who have to deal with the inmates and the transportation and the safety of both the inmates and the community when it comes to the transportation of witnesses. We welcomed anybody getting involved in the Christian Fernandez case because of the difficult nature of that case, and we worked diligently to reach what we believe to be an appropriate resolution in that case.
Lots of calls, meanwhile, for prosecutors Bernie De La Rionda and Mark Khalil. We had originally booked State Attorney Cori on this program. She was unable to be here, so they are taking your calls today as Harvard's Fair Punishment Project releases a new report looking at the death penalty in this county and others. Joel on the South Side. Hi, Joel. How are you?
Hi. I'm doing well. Thanks for taking my question. This is actually in response to Mr. Khalil's answer to the gentleman asking the economic costs of incarcerating somebody or executing them. You know, Mr. Khalil, you brought up the cost of justice, right? And I think that's very subjective. And on an issue like this, I think we should be as objective and as logical as possible. So logically speaking, I just don't see the argument for the death penalty over incarceration when it is cheaper. And even looking at it from a subjective point of view, I don't see how that gives the victims any more justice than if that person was serving a life sentence without parole. Thanks.
Okay. Bernie De La Rionda.
Well, I can tell you that the first death penalty case I got is a guy named Mark Asa. He's a white individual, killed two black men, and for no reason other than they were black. And he's been on death row since 1988. Part of the cost is that it takes so long for the execution actually to go through. And so I think that's the problem, that it's taken so long. Now, that law has been changed recently, and now they have a period of time in which they have to do it. So I would think there would be a cost savings in terms of if we could speed up the process so it doesn't take as long.
We're getting lots of feedback on social media, meanwhile, as we speak to the top prosecutors in the state attorney's office. On our Facebook Live page, Camille writes, "She does a great job. I'm very proud of Angela Cori. She's very realistic about situations that are presented." Meanwhile, here is another tweet for both of you. "Do your guests have a comment about this data? States without the death penalty have lower murder rates." And that's from the Death Penalty Information Center website.
I would ask the person who posed that question to look at the violent crime statistics and the murder statistics in Chicago this year. Chicago recently implemented within the last decade a moratorium, or Illinois did, on the death penalty. And unfortunately, Chicago has become a killing field within the United States.
Well, you know, I lived in Chicago in the 90s when they released a lot of men on death row that DNA evidence found were innocent. And the governor at the time, Ryan, who, by the way, later went to prison on something totally different, he instituted a death penalty moratorium because there were too many death row inmates that were found to be innocent. What would you say to those? Of course, this is a very divisive issue. But what would you say to those who would prefer to err on the side of not sending someone to their death if there's evidence that later finds they didn't do the crime?
Obviously, that's a nightmare type situation for any prosecutor, any human being, to think that an innocent person may be subjected to any punishment, let alone the death penalty. And I think the safeguards have to be in place that you have to have diligent prosecutors who unturn every stone, who work day in, day out to seek justice and make sure those things do not occur. And I can't speak to what happened in Chicago, just as I couldn't speak to what has happened across the country in other areas. But what I can speak to is the hard work that the prosecutors in my 20 years have been doing in trying to achieve justice for the citizens of Jacksonville and to make sure that the appropriate sentences are imposed regardless of the circumstances and regardless of who the individuals may be.
Let's go to Peggy in Mandarin now. Hi, Peggy. Thanks for holding. Good morning.
Hi. On one hand, I think the victims' families should be asked if they want the death penalty, because many times the families don't want to go through the appeals again and have to relive all this. If they're given a life sentence, they just go away and the families don't have to hear about it. But they go through appeals and it drags the family emotionally back down. So that's a different point of view.
Yeah, thanks for that, Peggy.
That's an excellent point, and quite frankly, having tried a bunch of death penalty cases and handled a bunch of death penalty cases, I have found we factor in, number one, we talk to the victim's family, and obviously we factor in terms of their wishes, but the end result, we have to do the right thing, because there are cases where we feel the death penalty is not appropriate and the victim's family asks for the death penalty. But quite frankly, in most of my cases, I'd say 98% of them, the victim's family, they want the death penalty. And they just don't want the death penalty in terms of the method we have now to execute. They want the victim to suffer the defendant to suffer the same way their loved one. So if the victim was stabbed 89 times, they want the defendant to be stabbed 89 times. That's what I have found in my cases where the victim's family want justice for their loved one.
Do either of you have reaction, meanwhile, to the coalition of faith leaders, including Bishop Estevez of the Catholic Diocese of St. Augustine? In the wake of the Harvard report, they've called for a moratorium on the death penalty in this area. Your reaction to that?
If I could, being Catholic, I respect the bishop, and I've been a Catholic my whole life, but I respectfully disagree. I firmly believe in the death penalty, and I believe pastors do great things, bishops do great things, priests do awesome things, and thank God we have them. Thanks God we have people who are so concerned about the well-beings of people. But the end result, the Bible, both Old and New Testament, talk about thou shalt not commit murder.
Well, we appreciate you both being here, gentlemen. Prosecutors Bernie DeLorianda and Mark Khalil joining us in lieu of the state attorney who couldn't be here this morning. Thanks for joining the program.
Thank you.
It's been a pleasure.
And much more still ahead. Later, we've got a few ideas for your weekend. But up next, a local child abduction case ends happily thanks to the Hague Convention. We'll explain right after this.
WJCT's Goodbye Summer Auction is where you'll find over 300 items, most starting at 75% off at auction.wjct.org. Packages include lodging, attractions, dining, recreation, beauty, and more. Bid now. The auction continues through August 31st at 8 p.m. Log on to auction.wjct.org for more information.
I'm Fred Child. Join me in the great outdoors for a musical celebration of the 100th anniversary of the National Park Service. We'll spend a full hour making music inside Grand Teton National Park, and we'll think about connections between music and nature. On the next Performance Today from APM.
Weeknights at 7 on 89.9 WJCT.
I'm David Luckin, host of the Electro Lounge, inviting you to join me Tuesday through Saturday nights on 89.9 when we bring you music from around the world. All styles played, all songs considered. Join me for the Electro Lounge, Tuesday through Saturday nights.
Presenting Next Avenue, a website from WJCT created specifically for adults discovering life after 50. Visit us at wjct.org/nextavenue.
Sponsored in part by AARP. Real possibilities.
Welcome back. Well, it's a civil remedy for international child abduction cases. The Hague Convention was originally created to protect children. And with increased global relationships, it has often been a lifesaver for parents. These cases are going to continue to increase as we have more international marriages and kids born to parents from different countries and cultures. Now, one of these heartbreaking cases played out recently here in Northeast Florida. Jacksonville attorney April Geer won this local case for a terrified mother and her son. And she joins us now with more about the family and what the Hague Convention is all about. And April, good to see you.
Good morning.
Thanks for being here. Let's first explain what the Hague Convention is and what it does. Can you explain it for our listeners?
Sure. So the Hague Convention, the formal name is the Hague Convention on the Civil Aspects of International Child Abduction, and it is really the primary civil remedy for parents seeking the return of their children when the other parent has either removed them or retained them in another country that is also a party to the treaty.
Right. And so it's not often used, particularly in this circuit, you would not normally see the Hague Convention invoked in a Jacksonville courtroom, right?
Correct.
Yeah. So how did this come about then, that a family appealed for emergency relief via the Hague Convention?
So the Hague Convention requires that the petition for return is filed in the jurisdiction where the kid is located. And so the mother and the child were both in St. John's. They were outside of Tallahassee. And so that's where he ended up having to file the Hague petition.
So Lauren Jones and her son, Rui, went through a terrible ordeal.
They did.
Let's go back to the beginning. Lauren had Rui in February of 2011.
Yes.
Her then-husband was from Honduras.
Correct.
What happened next?
So Lauren actually went to Roatan as a dive instructor, and while she was there, she met him. They fell in love. They got married. They had the child. And in 2012, they came to the United States for a wedding, and it was there that a very bad altercation occurred, and she made the decision then, I'm not going back to Honduras. And he left, and she stayed. And that was the basis for the petition.
And so at what point did she become concerned that she was going to lose her son?
Well, this case is interesting because the father is actually an attorney in Honduras, and he had actually worked on several Hague conventions before. And so he sort of knew the ins and outs and what he needed to do, what he needed to say, so that he was on top at every step. Mm-hmm. He filed some cases against her in Honduras. He filed a case against her stepdad in Honduras, and she lost custody in Honduras. He didn't tell her any of this. She thought they were on the same page, and then when he went home for Christmas, he never came back. He never sent the kid back, and that's when she flew down, immediately went to the embassy, and tried to get him back.
And then what happened? How did it all end up in a courtroom here in front of Judge Hinkle? He's the one who ruled on this case.
He is. So when she went back to get him, he would not let her see him. He had all of the courts on his side. She lost custody. She had to have supervised visitation. And he made her do some things to prove her loyalty to him, which she did. And then he signed something allowing her to go back to the States to get an emergency dental procedure. And she was in constant communication with the embassy, and they said, look, say what you got to say, sign what you got to sign, get back to the U.S. And that's what she did. And she knew as soon as she got to the U.S., she was not going back, and neither was her son.
But there was a chance he could be sent back.
There was.
If not for the Hague Convention.
Correct.
So why did Judge Hinkle rule in her favor in the end?
So the Hague Convention requires that the child be sent back except there are a few small exceptions to that, and one of them is grave risk. If there is a grave risk to the child, either physical or psychological, then the court has the discretion to not send the child back. And that's where a lot of mothers that are fleeing from domestic violence are using that exception to be able to stay in the second country with the children.
There was a case that I don't know invoked the Hague Convention or not, but it involved the actress from the show Gossip Girl. And she married a German guy. He took the kids to Monaco. She tried to get them back and lost. She lost. Her children are still there, and she's basically lost her children. And they were U.S. citizens. So
it happens a lot.
That can happen. Mm-hmm. That can happen more often than people realize.
More often than not, yes.
And why is that?
The Hague Convention is very hard because it is a very strict timeline. It's 6 weeks from start to finish. And so there is a lot of work to get in, a lot of evidence to get in. And it's a very hard case to fight, and it's very hard to get a win.
Now, you work with UC Berkeley on this initiative. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Sure. So UC Berkeley has a project, and it is housed at the Goldman School of Public Policy at UC Berkeley. And they have developed a program and a guide for attorneys, and it's specific to battered mothers who are facing a petition for the return of the child. So when we received the case, it was 3 days before our first pretrial hearing. And so while researching it, I thankfully came across their guide, and it had a lot of really good information in it. And we ended up using some of the ideas that they had in there, some of the arguments that they had posed. And so when we won, I sent them an email and said, you know, thank you so much for putting all of the time into this. It really did help us and give us an insight into how this affects battered mothers especially. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so they responded and said, thank you. We don't hear this a lot. And so we've been working with them since then, and they've sent us a few other cases.
And isn't the most common question you get asked, I'm so afraid that if I invoke this Hague Convention, it will only cause my ex-spouse to retaliate more strongly against me, and it might even make it harder. Aren't you asked pretty often, is there really a chance I'm going to win?
That is the number one question that we get asked, and a lot of times they say, I need to know, I need a guarantee that I'm going to win, because if I go back, it's going to be 10 times worse now that I have provoked him even more. If we get sent back, if the child gets sent back, I'm scared of what will happen next.
What advice do you have for people that are maybe in this situation, or that they could be in the future?
Winnable.
I mean, this sounds terrible to say, but based on this case and the ones you've shared, marrying someone from another country is something you need to carefully consider in case the marriage fails and there are children involved.
That's very true. And there's very cultural differences. The courts are very different. The courts in Honduras are very different than the courts in the U.S. And I think that is why the U.S. Embassy in Honduras stressed to her, get back to the U.S. Whatever you have to do, get back to the U.S. And I think that the more people are meeting people online, they're traveling, they're doing a gap year, and then they're meeting people, they're getting married and having kids, or having kids without getting married, and then they get homesick and they want to come back, and they realize it's now 10 times harder. And when they do leave, they're faced with the petition or criminal charges, whatever the other parent wants to do.
It is the Hague Convention, a little known statute dealing with international child custody disputes, used successfully here in Jacksonville by April Gear. It's Gillis Way and Campbell.
Gillis Way and Campbell, yes.
Thank you so much for telling us about it. Fascinating.
Thank you for having me.
And we'll be right back.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, a new study concludes that America's aging population is slowing the economy's growth, As baby boomers retire in large numbers, what the age effect means for workplace productivity, wages, and economic performance.
At 10 o'clock on 89.9 WJZT, your community, your world.
Hi, I'm John Braun. I'm an emergency planner for the city of Jacksonville, Florida. Individuals with special needs should register annually for assistance with evacuation to shelters. Visit jacksready.com for more information and tune to 89.9, the designated emergency broadcaster for Northeast Florida.
This segment is brought to you by Colo CSX Data Center Hosting Solutions.
WJCT and Community First Credit Union are pleased to announce that Pedro Noguera, national expert on public education in America, is this year's morning keynote speaker at Teach, Saturday, October 8th at the Hyatt Regency Hotel. Tickets are $30. For more information, visit wjct.org/teach.
Welcome back. Well, if you love WJCT, show us on Instagram. We'll publish our favorite Instagram photo of the week tomorrow in our First Read e-newsletter. Just make sure that when you post your photo on Instagram, use the hashtag #ILoveWJCT and subscribe to First Read at WJCTnews.org. Well, the Ruby Diamond Concert Hall at Florida State will host a special performance next Thursday night featuring five Steinway Art Case pianos from the collection of Tallahassee entrepreneur and museum owner DeVoe Moore. And the Five Browns, a classical piano ensemble of five amazingly talented siblings, is going to perform on these rare Steinways at this first-of-its-kind free event. Take a listen. That's the Five Browns performing a little Rhapsody in Blue. Right now, we're going to hear all about this from Christopher Hecox. He's director of Opening Night's Performing Arts with Florida State University, and he's on the line now with a preview of this very exciting and free concert. Hey, Chris, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Melissa.
So Steinway, the world's premier piano manufacturer, is co-sponsoring this whole event. Let's start with the Steinway piece. Five Steinway pianos and one for each of the five Browns. How did this all come about?
So we're very fortunate in Tallahassee to have DeVoe Moore, who is, again, an entrepreneur, a big supporter of the university, and he owns the Tallahassee Carr Museum, which some visitors to the area might have been to. But the Carr Museum is much more than cars. There's a lot of collectibles, and he also collects Steinway art case pianos. He actually has eight of them and has, as you can imagine, an amazing relationship with the Steinway Corporation. And they've been working for a couple of years to come up with a program to showcase these pianos all in one place and under one roof. And who better to play five of the art case pianos than the Five Browns?
The Five Browns are really incredible. The first family of five siblings to have attended Juilliard School. Three CDs that have climbed to number one on the Billboard Classical chart. What are they going to be performing?
Yeah, it's a great program. Very excited. I mean, works that your audience definitely know, The Moldau by Smetana, Rhapsody in Blue. They're doing some Rachmaninoff, Mozart, I mean, Debussy. They're all across the board. Just a really, really good program.
Yeah, this is going to be a great show. And it's free, as we said, but you've got to get your tickets beforehand. Go to tickets.fsu.edu or call the FSU Fine Arts Ticket Office. Chris Hecox on the line for us from FSU. He's director of Opening Night's Performing Arts there. Thanks so much for being with us. It's going to be a great show.
Thanks for having me.
And finally, this hour, from a music giveaway to some ideas for your weekend, It's David Luckin here today.
Oh, no. What am I doing here?
Our music director and Electro Lounge host stepping in.
Can you play that Rhapsody in Blue again?
It'll take her just a second to cue it up. But why not?
That was gorgeous.
Wasn't it?
That will be a great concert.
Absolutely.
What's going on, Melissa?
All right. Right now, I see that you have brought me...
Well, not you, one of our lucky listeners.
Yeah, actually, I don't get to keep this. It's Bob Dylan, 1965-66, the Cutting Edge Sampler, the Bootleg Series, Volume 12. This is a CD giveaway from our own David Luckin. Whoever likes Bob Dylan, if you want this free CD, email us right now.
Electro Lounge listeners only.
Email us right now at firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Some of these are rehearsal cuts.
Yeah, this is, they've done the bootleg series for about 10 years, and they're great box sets with rare and unreleased material. This is a sampler from the latest box. The box is actually about four CDs. This is just the cream of the crop here for one lucky listener.
Yeah, so email us now. If you want the CD, we will pick one winner at random. For Bob Dylan, 1965-1966, the Cutting Edge Sampler, part of his Bootleg Series. This is early and often unheard, previously unreleased tracks by Bob Dylan. And I'm sure there'll be a lot of takers on this
Absolutely.
One.
Absolutely. Melissa, do you know what you missed Tuesday night?
No, but I know you're going to tell me.
Kicking off the Kubrick Film Festival series at the Sunray, they played The Shining. But not to worry, there's a whole lot of films from now until October. Check it out, all the great Kubrick films, including the ones that most people don't know, the ones from the 40s and 50s, like The Killing, and some other early ones. I don't have the list in front of me, but well worth checking out. Go to Sunray Cinema, see some great Kubrick from 2001, The Shining. Well, that one just aired. Full Metal Jacket, Eyes Wide Open.
Yeah, Eyes Wide Shut.
I'm glad you're here, Melissa, to keep me in, to make me sound smart.
I'll keep you between the lines.
Exactly.
Here.
So Kubrick at the Sunray. That's all I have to say.
Okay.
Look it up.
And here's a few that The Spectator sent me. She couldn't be here today. Tonight it's Blues, Brews, and BBQ benefiting the Florida Theater, live entertainment with Mama Blue and Smokestack.
I think they're closing the street for that. They're going to do it right out front.
Right in front of the Florida
It'll
Theater.
Be a great night.
That's going to be great. Tomorrow night it's an evening of Promise benefiting Nemours with Honorable Chairs Mayor Lenny Curry and Mrs. Molly Curry. And let's talk about this quickly. All the Angels Come Friday and Saturday at Players by the Sea. This is a play and novel written by big friend of the show, Jim Alabiso.
Sure, absolutely.
That's going to be a good show.
Guaranteed. Also, speaking of theater, Alhambra is doing Smokey Joe's Cafe tonight at 6 and 8. So if you like
You know what? Every time I drive by, packed parking lot.
Absolutely.
People love that show.
Well, it's all the great music of Lieber and Stoller, who wrote all those great songs for the Drifters and Elvis and everybody else. So
that's
a great show. I've seen it. It's well worth the time and the effort. Plus, it's live, so you can't beat that. Sing Out Loud Music Festival. You may have been hearing that promo on our air. Great festival, including Booker T. Reason enough to go see him. It's free down in St. Augustine. Just check out shoutoutloudfestival.com and get all the details. Free music in St. Augustine. That's
okay. Also Saturday, it's Pop Dance Party in the Park. Dance to the best hits of the 80s and 90s in Hemming Park. There's also going to be a fashion show, live dance competition, food trucks, kids zone, beer, wine, and cocktails. So Hemming Park's had some problems recently, as we all know. Funding problems, fought problems with City Hall. They are continuing, though, to program stuff in the park every day.
Good for them.
Yeah. So go on out Saturday and enjoy the fun and excitement and music of Dance Party in the Park. That's just about it on my list. Let's also note that on Sunday, the Jaguars play the Bengals in a preseason game. My family, they're long-suffering Bengals fans.
I'm sure.
Not Bungles fans.
Yeah, you're probably right there with that Chicago team. What do they call them? The White Sox?
No, I was a Northsider. I was a Cubs fan.
But what, they've made the playoffs once in 100 years, I think. But
we won't talk about that.
No. A preview, September 23rd, Unity Plaza. You know where that is, Melissa? You ever been over there?
I have been over there.
Absolutely. We've gone for lunch there.
Yeah.
WJCT is going to put on a thank you concert for free on the 23rd. We've got five or six great local bands, and it's just our way of saying thank you to the community. We will have wrapped up our pledge drive.
That's right.
And that's our way of saying thank you for all the great support all year long.
Time and date again?
7 to 10, September 23rd, Unity Plaza, live Electro Lounge broadcast with live music.
That is going to be excellent. Everyone needs to come on out, enjoy Unity Plaza. It's a free event. You can come out and meet David, ask him about all his music tracks.
You'll be there. Come on.
Yeah,
we're gonna
I'll
get
be
as
there.
Many. Ryan Bank is going to be the MC on the stage. I'll fill in with music while the bands reset. So it's going to be a fun night. 3 hours of live radio. So if you lament that there's no live radio anymore, well, we'll have it, and you can come and shout and be on the radio. It's going to be a fun night.
Absolutely. Thanks for stepping in this morning.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And that's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers today. Our producer is Kevin Mershart. Michelle Corum is running the board. And the show theme is composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony's Pyotr Chepchik.
There's the music.
There's a little more Five Browns for you. Never miss a show. Subscribe to the podcast on iTunes and watch our show, Video on Demand, at our partner TVJax.com. Next on Diane Rehm, a new study finds America's aging population is slowing the economy's growth. A closer look next. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT FM Jacksonville. Your community, your world. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow for a Friday Media Roundtable. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.